Good morning to you. Good to have you with us today. As always, I appreciate a chance to share some thoughts with you from the scriptures. Psalm 131 is our text for today. And today is my bookend lesson for our series on the seven churches of Revelation. It's not all that there is to say, but it's all that I have to say for now. And anytime you can get a preacher to admit that, it's a good thing, right? What were Brady's words in the scripture reading? More words, more vanity. What advantage are more words? So we'll put a bookend on this series and move on to something else next time I'm up here. Early on in my series, it was the Revelation 2 and 3, thank you, the churches in Asia Minor received letters from Jesus. We know some of the beginnings of these churches. I'd like to, if you can stick around until the end, talk a little bit about some of how these churches ended. But in the middle is where Jesus comes to these churches, and he writes something to them. Is crisis the only thing that there is to midlife? I mean, is that all that there is crisis? Jesus comes to them, if you can recall the book of Revelation. A lot of the book of Revelation is spiritual imagery of good and evil, but almost all of what happens in Revelation, Jesus says it's soon to pass. Speaking to churches in about 50 AD, Jesus is saying the tribulation, the persecution of the destruction of Jerusalem, and the persecution of Rome, it's soon to pass. And so much of what happens in that book is something that has already happened. And Jesus comes to them and he says, there's this big crisis as you're about in the middle of your spiritual life. Churches, there's this big crisis coming on the whole world, and I want you to be prepared. But what we've been looking at is not the world crisis that was happening in those days. Jesus brings a second crisis to these churches, and it's more of an internal congregational struggle. He sees exactly what these churches are, who they are, what they struggle with, and in a few brief verses, he tells them, here's how I commend you, and here's how I condemn you, and here's what you need to work on. Early on in the series, several of you came up with where I really wanted to get to by the end, so you're way ahead of me. So we know what Jesus said to Smyrna and Laodicea and Ephesus. What would Jesus say to us? What would his letter to the Valley Church be? I'm going to totally sidestep that question, and I want to go to how do we prepare ourselves to receive a letter such as that. If I tried to pen that letter, I think I would not commend you where you need to be commended, and I wouldn't be hard on you where you need to be hard on. And so I want us to think about how do we reflect, what reflections do we need to make in our life to respond to the message? What kind of things do you reflect on so that the singing you hear today and the praying and the scriptures and the message, that you can respond to it? Don't we need to prepare for hearing the Word of God? Psalm 131, as Isaac said, is a psalm of ascents. To ascend means you're going up. And this is what the spiritual Jew, the praying Israelite. If you have a children's bulletin, it's the yellow one. Nathaniel was referred to as a true Israelite in whom there is no guile or no deceit. That's the kind of person we're talking about in Psalm 131. And they would make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And these are the songs that they would sing and that they would pray and they would dwell on as they were preparing to hear God's revelation at a period of worship at the temple. He speaks of a child that has been weaned, right? That is no longer dependent upon milk only, but is ready for something meatier, is ready to be educated. It's really a profound three verses where we're going to spend our time today. This is not something that he says after he's been to the excitement of the worship and the celebration. You know that high, the mountaintop experience? This isn't in response to what he's heard. This is preparing himself for that mountaintop experience. And so I'd like to turn this into a reflection of our preparation to receive the words of the Spirit. Where I'd like to start is the first part of verse 1. O Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. He's reflecting here, I think, upon his pride. And I'd like us to have the image of eyes. You can tell a lot about a person by their body language. If the heart is right, if the pride of the heart is where it should be, then where are somebody's eyes? What's indicative of where their eyes are? If someone's shuffling along with their eyes down at the ground, they probably have a low self-image, a low self-esteem, right? They're not they're thinking too low of themselves. And what about if, as the psalmist says, what if their eyes are too high? What if they look over the top of everybody? You get the sense that, oh, well, they're too good for me. If the heart is right, then the eyes will be level. And the psalmist, as he's approaching, this praying Israelite, as he's approaching Jerusalem, going up the hill in this time of worship with his fellow Israelites, he's saying, I don't want to be haughty or prideful. I don't want my eyes to be too high. He wants to have self-respect, but he doesn't want to get stuck in self-worship. I don't know who took the picture of the handsome little fella here, right, looking into the glass, or who painted it, I would assume. This here is a picture of, right, the Greek Narcissus. Do you remember? He was the guy who thought he was so attractive. And yet, what did he get stuck doing? He got stuck looking down at his own self, looking up in that reflection, and he just died there, right? He was so absorbed in who he was and had such a high opinion of himself that he got stuck. I had read recently that, you know, sexual sins or sins of substance abuse are terrible in their own right. But it is often pride and ego that rots the church from the inside. It's pride and ego that's at the heart of moral failings. Somebody who says, well, I'm too good to worry about this, or I'm good enough that I can handle this temptation, are often the ones who could say that pride goes before their fall. Or maybe someone's the flip side. They have such a low image of themselves, right? They just have very little positive perspective of who they are, and they think, well, I'm not important enough to treat myself right. Maybe work goes undone when you think, I'm too good for that work, or you think, well, I'm not good enough to do that work. Or relationships go unattended to. I'm below that person, or what do I possibly have to say to that person? My eyes are not raised too high. They're right where they should be. If you recall the poor church in Smyrna and the church of little power in Philadelphia, or Philly, right, as some might say, Jesus lifts up their eyes. They had kind of a low opinion of themselves, and Jesus lifts them up, and he says, you're poor materially, but you're rich spiritually, and hold on to that. And to Philly, he says, you don't have a lot of influence politically, but you respect the authority of Jesus, and that's really what counts. And then what about to the eyes of places like Ephesus? Do you remember? They were spot on when it came to the doctrine of the church, and yet their love was ice cold. And so Jesus lowers their gaze a little bit. He says, you better not forget to love people. Laodicea, They were so rich that they didn't think that they needed anything. Jesus cuts them down to size. And Sardis, right, the busy church that was actually dead and not doing anything, Jesus tells them, you need to wake up. In preparation for receiving the words of the Spirit that he would say to us, I don't know that Jesus would say a lot. He would get right at the heart of the matter. And to prepare ourselves for those words, we can ask, how are my eyes? How is my pride? Sometimes we go to church and we say, I want to be uplifted and I want to be encouraged. And sometimes we need that. But have you ever gone saying, you know, I really need to be humbled? I mean, sometimes we need the church to lift us up, but I think sometimes we need the church to humble us, to remind us of who we are and that we need each other and that we're not too good for each other and that the work of the church is not below what he would have us to do. Preparing ourselves about thinking, how is my pride? Connected with pride, let's continue. He says, oh Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. I don't occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me, but I have calmed and quieted my soul. Like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me. He reflects now upon, and I'll use hands as the image here, but what he can do with his hands, what his abilities are. I had some trouble with the image of a weaned child. What is that even? Genesis 21:8. Abraham, when Isaac was weaned, Abraham, it says that he threw a big feast. Would you think to have a party when you wean your child? Hey, they're off of milk and they're eating real food and they're not just seeking mom because she's a source of food, but because they want to be comforted by mom beyond just what she gives them materially. Abraham threw a party over that. It was a big deal because so often in those days, right, infant mortality, I mean, infancy is dangerous today, but back then, man, you were blessed. You were fortunate if you made it out of that dangerous time of infancy. And so they threw a big party. Hannah in 1 Samuel 1:22. Remember, Hannah had the boy Samuel, and she had dedicated him to the Lord. And it was at that moment when he was weaned that she says, okay, I've been preparing for this. Now I'm making my move to commit this child, to leave my house. It's one thing to be like, all right, kid, you're 16 or you're 20, you know, you're 18, time to leave the house. But you've just weaned the lad, and you're going to send him off? Talk about, I doubt she had trouble with the boomerang generation, right? She was definitely an empty nester. Having survived infancy, having moved from the milk to more meatier sustenance, something you see in children, right, as they transition, what word do they learn first? Or what word do they tend to learn first? No, right? Which can be frustrating. But it's a sign that they're starting to learn their limits, right? What they want and what they don't want. Another word that they learn early on is help. Help me, right? I need help with this. I've just fallen off this chair. Help me get back up. They're learning what their abilities are. And, you know, as adults, let's bring this all full circle. As adults, isn't it comforting or calming to be given a task that is within your own ability? On the flip side, how frustrating is it to be asked to do something that you just don't have the tools for, that you don't have the skills or the experience for? Now, I'm not talking about using our, well, I just don't have the ability, God. You know, you give me this command, but I don't want to do it because I don't have the ability. Let's put in perspective this fella who is traveling. Okay, this isn't a guy who's using spiritual truths as an excuse to get out of work. I mean, he left his home. He left his home behind to travel to Jerusalem. He's taking his whole family with him. Do you think this guy is committed to the faith? There's no question of whether this guy is committed. And I love what he says here. I don't occupy myself with things too great or too marvelous or too difficult. You think you could make that journey? Leave your entire home and your livelihood? I'm just going to leave that for several weeks. And I'm going to go and I'm going to trust God. And I'm going to make this long journey to worship Him. The churches in Revelation were challenged, and they were asked to make a great journey toward being more Christ-like. But when Jesus comes to them, he says, look, I know you're not rich, and I'm not asking you to be rich materially. I know you're not influential, and I'm not asking you to go to be the political powerhouse. I want you to be faithful. And I want you to submit to Jesus' authority, all things that were within their abilities. And so, reflecting upon what can I do? And if I don't know what to do, am I willing to ask for help? Do I know my place and do I know my part? Now think about that. Jesus is going to say something to us. And we check our pride. And we know really well what it is that we can do with our abilities and what our purpose and our place is. And then we come to something that I think is out of our control and that would have been out of their control. Verse 3. Psalm 131. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forevermore. And so I think the final thing that he, well, not the final thing, I think he's reflecting here upon things that are out of his control. Considering our pride and considering our abilities are things that we can control. Considering circumstances are often outside of our control. But he's asking the question, when he's saying, I've calmed my soul, do you have something that's stressing you? Maybe it's some future event. Do we have any big future events coming up in this church? On a lot of different levels, I guess there's always something coming up. But you're stressed, but you haven't identified what that thing is. And then finally it hits you. Oh, that's why I'm kind of irritable, right? That's why I'm not sleeping very well. That's why I'm eating differently. That's why I've thrown my schedule off. Because there's some circumstance out there that's completely out of my control, but I'm not turning it over to God. This is what the majority or the lion's share of the book of Revelation is about. Once you finish Revelation chapter 3 and you get to chapter 4 through the end of the book, Jesus is saying, hey, these things are going to come, and they're going to come soon. And the Bible, it almost changes from like a radio, which you turn on and you hear, and it becomes almost like television. Read the book of Revelation. Isn't it well suited for some kind of television show? Unfortunately, people have taken it and made it into some really bad television shows. But it's this imagery of what's going to happen, and there's battles. And sin is being atoned for, and things are happening to Satan, and there's kingdoms, and there's monsters, and there's all kinds of wild things going on. But what's the message of the majority of the book of Revelation? It's that Jesus has taken care of all those things that are outside of our control. All those circumstances that control our life, or seem to control our life, Jesus has handled them. The destruction of Jerusalem, like the destruction of the city that's nearest to you, right? I mean, think about the destruction of our capital city in this state. Wouldn't that be devastating? And wouldn't you think I have no control over what's going on? They were facing the destruction of Jerusalem and an all-powerful government hunting them down and destroying them for being who Christ had called them to be. And so here's what the psalmist does, and it goes along so much with what Jesus says. What are your anxieties over uncontrollable circumstances? Do you identify those? Because we have to identify them. And I think identifying them is in prayer is the right thing. And then do we hold them up to what Jesus has said? The end of Revelation 22, verse 6. He said to me, "These words are trustworthy and true. And the Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, has sent his angel to show his servants what must soon take place. And behold, I am coming soon. Blessed is the one who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book." And verse 12, "Behold, I am coming soon, bringing my recompense with me to repay everyone for what he has done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end." The psalmist speaks to his brethren in verse 3. He says, "O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time and forevermore." Those things in your life that are out of your control, identify what they are and submit them and place them before and struggle with them in the presence of God and the hope that he gives. Jesus assures the churches by reminding them the true nature of crisis. Remember at the beginning, I said that Jesus came and he says, there's this global crisis, but you've got stuff going on in your midst that you need to handle. But I want us to think about, as we close here, the true nature of crisis. Maybe you've had a crisis recently, and my first reaction is a total loss of control. Isn't that what a crisis seems like, or what we often interpret a crisis as? Is I'm totally out of control, and I've just been reminded at how little control I have. The word crisis is actually not about a total loss of control. We are led to think that way, but it's from the Latin word decision. Now that's odd, right? Here's a situation in which I'm supposed to have no control, but it really comes from this idea of decision. And so rather than defining a crisis that is something that we have no control over, I think it's a reminder of all the things we think we have control over that we really don't. And that can be jarring. When we think we have control over so much and something happens and it reminds us of how much little power we have. But in that moment of reflection, of checking our pride and understanding what our abilities are and trusting that God is that God is a king over everything, can bring us to that important turning point. That turning point when we realize, well, here's the few things that I can have a say over in my life. I have control over my pride. I have control over what I do with my abilities. And I have control over the person that I trust in. It's a turning point where we decide, do I give in to the hopelessness? Or do I accept what Jesus has given to me? I said I'd get to the end of some of the churches. Now, there's no doubt about it that the promises and the warnings in Revelation have all come to pass, and guess what? We're all still here, right? Is the church still in existence that was so horribly threatened back in Revelation? Jesus handled the big crisis, and I think he'll continue to handle the big crisis. Some churches submitted to what Jesus said, and they said, all right, we don't have a lot of power, but we are going to improve and handle what we can. Those churches, poor Smyrna and weak Philadelphia. Not only are there still cities in Smyrna and Philadelphia today, but there's a Christian influence in those places to this day. How about places like lukewarm Laodicea and dead Sardis? Not only is there not a church there today, but there's not even a city in that part of the world. All of these churches faced a crisis globally, and they faced the personal challenge that Jesus brought to them. Some had prepared themselves by reflecting, prayerfully and preparing their heart, their soul, calming their soul, so that wouldn't drown out the words of Jesus. I don't know what our letter would be. It's probably not for one person to decide. Perhaps it would be a mixture of what is in the beginning of Revelation. Of course, probably sprinkled throughout the rest of Scripture. But our response begins. It begins today. It begins every day with quieting our souls so that we can hear what the Spirit says to the churches. I appreciate your attention today. If there's any way you need to respond, if you would like to partner and join with somebody in quieting your soul, if you'd like to know that God that helps you to quiet your soul in times of crisis, then come forward while we stand and sing together.